So welcome to the first Sustainability Forum City of Ann Arbor is putting on this year in 2016. Thank you all very much for coming. It is great to see you tonight. I'm delighted with the turnout today. We've got a terrific program lined up, great presenters discussing the most important issue facing the human race today, the climate crisis, and what you and I and our community can do to help keep the world a place where human beings can survive, and better yet, how human beings can thrive. Yeah, we've got a lot of big ideas to discuss tonight. So if you came here looking for the craft beer and the stand-up comedy, that is down the block, or you can go there later. So for those of you who aren't familiar with the Ecology Center, here's a brief public service announcement. We create innovative solutions for healthy people and a healthy planet, and that's what we've been doing since 1970. I think many of you know we started Michigan's first recycling program. We closed down all 157 of Michigan's medical waste incinerators. We led the efforts to create the city's Greenbelt program and Washtenaw County's Natural Areas program. We created the country's only testing service for toxics and brand name consumer products, and we led the efforts to expand the transit services in the Ann Arbor Ypsilanti area. I have had the incredible good fortune to work on these issues myself for more than 20 years, and I want to kick off the introduction of tonight's big ideas by sharing a memory from early in my career. And I got to say, these comments, and I'm not going to use the 15 minutes that have been allotted on the agenda for me, but the comments I'm going to share are my opinion only. They do not reflect the opinion of the City of Ann Arbor or the Ann Arbor District Library. But the memory I wanted to share goes way back to a time, doesn't feel that long ago to me and maybe to some of you, but back to the time when Ronald Reagan was President of the United States, James Blanchard was Governor of Michigan. It was 1988. And the federal government's chief climate scientist, Dr. James Hansen, delivered testimony before Congress that truly let the world know that climate change was a serious problem, that it was primarily induced by human activity, and that the world needed to act decisively to leave our grandchildren a livable world. And the public attention, I remember this really well today, the public attention that that testimony received gave us all a lot of hope. It didn't hurt that the summer of 1988 was a sweltering one. At the time, Democrats and Republicans talked seriously about the need to act. And just a very short few years later, world leaders came together in Rio de Janeiro and agreed on the need and the framework for global action. One of our interns at the Ecology Center joined the Rio summit back then as part of a student delegation, and he got himself arrested demanding more action. At the time of the Rio meeting, it would have been possible to stabilize global climate temperatures with regular 2% annual greenhouse gas emission reductions, which were, yes, ambitious back then, but not technically overwhelming. 5 years after that, climate negotiators committed to real targets for carbon emission reductions in the Kyoto Protocol. We all had real reason to believe that something was going to get done. But then, Congress, many of you may remember, Congress refused to ratify the Kyoto Protocol. Delegates would then arrive from all over the world to the annual global COP, the Conference of the Parties, meetings with great ambition, and they'd leave with little or no progress. After President Obama got elected, in part, on a platform to pass comprehensive climate legislation, the bill got stopped in the Senate. One of our two great political parties made it a major political priority and a campaign slogan to drill, baby, drill. Remember that? And close to home, fairly modest but important ballot proposal to advance clean energy here in Michigan got defeated by a massive utility-funded advertising blitz. It was only 4 years ago. During the 20-some years since Rio, when annual 2% carbon reductions could have left the world with a pathway for a gradual shift to a virtually fossil-free world, we've actually increased emissions by roughly half. To meet the target, scientists tell us we'll need to meet what we'll need to meet to keep global temperatures now from rising no more than 2 degrees Celsius, we'll need to now reduce emissions more on the order of 8 to 10% per year. And we'll have to leave approximately 80% of the world's currently identified reserves of oil, gas, and coal in the ground. It's technically doable. It's politically challenging, to say the least. And it's kind of depressing, to put it mildly. But in the last 5 to 6 years, something else has begun to happen, and it gives me a lot of hope. First, very slowly, and then increasingly fast, ordinary people all over the world have stood up and they've demanded action. They organized rallies and actions, they protested the Keystone Pipeline, they blocked coal exports out of Northwest U.S. ports, they fought against fracking, they fought to close down the Line 5 pipeline under the Mackinac Straits, they called for pension funds and large institutions to divest their financial portfolios of fossil fuel company stocks. They clicked on the hashtag Act on Climate. And it hasn't just been a movement to keep fossil fuels in the ground and to fight against the man. It's also been marked, I think very importantly, by the development of local and independent solutions to create a clean energy future in communities all over the world, throughout Asia, Africa, Europe, and the Americas. In short, a remarkable global movement has emerged to call for a clean energy future before it's too late. And then, just last month, you all are aware, I think, on December the 12th, 195 nations reached an agreement in Paris to make the first substantial and verifiable agreements to reduce carbon emissions since the Rio summit. No doubt this happened because of the terrific leadership of President Obama, many other world leaders, but I would suggest that it mostly happened because the people have started to seriously mobilize. However, while the Paris commitments are substantial and they're verifiable, they are neither enforceable nor sufficient. We'll only succeed in stabilizing global temperatures if those commitments get enforced by diplomacy and by moral authority, and if the commitments get strengthened in the coming years. I'd suggest here that we'll only succeed in stabilizing global temperatures if people continue to mobilize and if local communities continue to act on their own. So bring it back home now. Three years ago, the city of Ann Arbor acted very forcefully by unanimously approving a climate action plan with over 80 action steps that would cumulatively reduce our carbon emissions 25% by 2025, and we set a goal of reducing emissions 90% by 2050. When Ann Arbor committed itself to this plan, it was one of the first cities in the country to do so. I'm proud to live in a city that demonstrates that kind of leadership. I'm proud that we have historically taken leadership actions to make this community one of the leaders in sustainability throughout the country. I also believe that, as a community, we have not yet really come to grips with the scale of the changes that we're going to need to make good on our plan. Two years ago, the Ecology Center convened the Ann Arbor Climate Partnership to help advance the action steps in the climate plan. 3 days ago, we issued a report about the progress to date, and we'll hear more about that in a few minutes from Nate Geisler. But the bottom line is we've got a lot of work to do. So tonight, what we're going to do is to hear about what's been going on in our town as we try to make good on our promises. We're going to hear about the University of Michigan's efforts, about the city's efforts, both from the perspective of city staff and from that of the city's Energy Commission. And we're going to close with a personal and global reflection from one of our community's energy experts. After our panel talks, we've left a lot of time for questions, discussions, and hopefully steps forward. Perhaps we'll come up with the great new idea that moves climate solutions forward faster in our community, faster than ever. I hope that you leave this event better informed about the state of climate action in Ann Arbor, clearer about the magnitude of the work that we need to undertake, and hopeful about our prospects to succeed. So first off, we're going to hear about the climate, energy, and sustainability efforts underway at the University of Michigan, source of about 25% of Ann Arbor carbon emissions. Our speaker is Anya Dale, who works out of the Office of Campus Sustainability at U of M. She's a visionary urban planner who previously worked for Washtenaw County on a number of transportation and energy issues, and she was a leader on the Board of Trustees at the Ann Arbor Area Transportation Authority as it developed its successful recent expansion plans. So please join me in welcoming Anya Dale.
Hello. So yes, I'm with the University of Michigan, and some of you may know, but I'll go over anyways, that we have some sustainability goals for the university, and I won't go through all of them, but I'm primarily going to talk to you a little bit about what we're doing around the energy goals, and I'll cover a little bit of some other things. But as Mike had mentioned, we have quite a big impact on what's happening across the city. About a quarter of the emissions come from our operations. It's really sort of a city within a city, which I've come to realize since working there for the past 4 or 5 years. Counting all of the staff and the students together, it's about 80 or 90,000 people. So that's a lot, and a lot of these operations run 24 hours a day if you're looking at the health system and stuff like that. So it's quite a big impact. And so one of the big goals that we have set for ourselves is to reduce our greenhouse gas emissions 25% below our 2006 baseline by 2025. So you can see our chart. The blue is our goal, and the yellow is where we are. So unfortunately, this past as of 2014, we're actually a little bit higher than we were in 2016, and that is really largely because of the way the goal was set. So we don't have, the goal does not factor in how we've grown as a university. So if you look at per capita or per square footage, where our energy use is going down, but we keep growing and growing. So altogether, I guess since 2006, we have added 6.5 million square feet. So while there have been a lot of efforts to decrease our energy use per building and make the buildings more efficient, and I'll talk a little bit about that on the next slide, overall, our usage is not decreasing as we would like to see. So really briefly, some of the existing things that we have going on. The goal, we have a goal specifically to reducing energy use in our buildings, and then we have a goal to reduce our energy use, or essentially our increase our fuel efficiency within our fleet so that we're reducing it by about 30%. So some of the things we're doing, we have an energy management team that has been working to reduce our energy use within the buildings, and those are the general fund buildings, which is about half of the buildings. So they're putting a lot of effort into it, and we're avoiding a lot of, I've heard different numbers, but on the scale of millions of dollars worth of energy bills per year because of those energy conservation measures that they're looking at. We also do things like, in addition to requiring our LEED buildings, or buildings to be LEED if they are more than $10 million in construction costs. We also have, and I think this is significant and worth mentioning, ASHRAE plus, it's actually plus 30. That was a mistake on my part. So those are our energy code requirements we have elected to exceed by 30%. So I think that there's some real stuff that the university is doing to make new buildings or existing buildings more efficient and the new buildings to be built so they're more efficient. And then also around our fuel efficiency, we have 20 hybrid buses now, and we're looking at a lot of other things, articulated buses, different ways that we can try to increase our efficiency per passenger, as well as putting a lot of effort into things like the Ann Arbor Bike Share and a bike rental program. And we recently got the bike-friendly university at the silver level, so just trying to make it a little bit easier for people to get around campus by bike. But as I mentioned, despite all of those things, you saw where we sort of are as our goal across the entire university. And President Schlissel, who came on a year or so ago, noticed that some of our goals we're doing really well on and some of our goals we're not doing as well on. And so he convened some working groups to really look at what are some of the holdups and what are some things that we can do to really make some real progress towards those goals. And it was a team that pulled together a bunch of recommendations, and of those recommendations, a few got approved to move forward, and some of the other ones might be revisited. But I'll cover some of the things that were approved for us to start working on that hopefully will make a real impact, right? So sort of the big one is expanding the use of cogeneration at our central power plant. So I don't know if everybody knows that we have a power plant on campus, but we do. And it is it services about half of the campus and provides about a third of the energy use. So we get the rest of it from our local energy utility, and that is really coming from coal. And this is a steam plant, so it's about twice as efficient. You know, you're using natural gas, and then the off-put steam that you get, we're cycling that back through. So it's a more efficient way. So by adding a couple of turbines to that, hopefully we can use more of our energy through that and less through our coal sort of supported provider. So we're expecting that would have a pretty big ability to reduce our emissions overall. So that's a big one. Another thing is that a fund has been established for renewable energy demonstration projects. So these are really these are things that students and faculty could do, like a competition to do something that's on campus. It's really more about sort of developing a living and learning thing where folks can learn about renewable energy sources. And it has this one time over the 3-year period fund of $250,000. So we're trying to figure out the details of how that's going to work. As far as an overall impact to our emissions, that's probably not going to have a huge thing just because of the scale is going to be smaller, but hopefully it's just sort of building that culture of sustainability and some knowledge. Something else that is going to happen, I mentioned the energy management team that's been doing all of these energy conservation measures across the general fund, half of the buildings. That's going to be expanded into the auxiliary, so like the rest of campus. We have the student life, which is housing and dining, also the health system and athletics. Those types of energy conservation measures that are making a pretty good impact, showing the reduction in energy use for those buildings, can be expanded to these buildings. So I just saw a presentation today where they said that overall there's been a 6% in the general fund buildings where they've done these, there's been overall 6% drop in the emissions and energy use. And so hopefully that's something that can carry through for the rest of campus. And then finally, there was a commitment from Schlissel that we would continue to pursue additional methods for greenhouse gas reduction. Some of those things would be looking at things that are off campus that can have a greater impact on reducing greenhouse gas emissions. We've started to look into a number of these. So some of these things are in progress. We're talking to the right people, but there hasn't really been a one or a certain number of projects that have been figured out exactly how we're going to do it. But there is an awareness that we need to do more than just the central power plant project and these other ones. So we're continuing to look and evaluate a couple of these options. So in addition to those things I mentioned, which are really focused on the operational goal to reduce our greenhouse gas emissions, there's a lot happening on campus around research specifically. So the Graham Institute is one example. There's a lot of things that come out of the Graham Institute and their research, including a hydraulic fracking report, which if you haven't seen it, you should go onto their website and check it out. It's very, very good. And the Climate Center also. They do a lot of work, as well as GLESA and GLACI, on trying to take the climate data that we're getting and trying to make that into something that can be used on the ground. So that's locally, but also it's looking at something that can be helping all of the cities really in the Great Lakes region. So it's taking the data and trying to make it into something tangible. And there's grants that are being used to really work with people and try to create or implement climate action plans. There's a number of other resources that you should check out. Some of these things, I don't want to read through all of it because I think I'm coming close on my time. but different impact tools where you can sort of see what can happen in a community based on the data and the projections. There's also the Energy Institute, which they do a lot of research on a number of things you see here listed. And really, there's 130 faculty over all 19 schools that that are doing research and related to energy. And the Institute right now is working on developing an energy minor. So that's hopefully another way we continue to build more research, more awareness around the students, and leading that into some of that student activity. So in addition to all of this staff and faculty that are sort of focused on working on these things, there's been a lot of student support for this. This is just a few of the student groups that focus on energy that are really active on campus. There's probably many, many, many more. So a lot of schools have their own energy group or club. A lot of these groups have representatives that, for example, were on that working group that President Schlissel called together for us to look at what we could do to address the goal. And something that I thought I would mention is in a couple of weeks, there are some delegates, some student delegates that were sent to Paris for these talks, and they are coming back and holding sort of, it sounds a bit like it's going to be a workshop, initial presentation on what they learned, and then people break out into working sessions and sort of talk about how that can be brought back and used sort of within U of M, but in the community in general, and I believe it's open to everybody. So I wanted to share that with folks. And then really quickly, I said that I would tell a little bit about how we're doing, but waste is another thing that we had the President Schlissel call a group together to look at what we could do, because it's another one that's been tricky. There's a lot of things that are being done, a lot of really cool, exciting things that are going to be done and were approved and funded. And next month, the forum will have someone from U of M talking about that. So you should come and hear about it. Yeah, I'll skip through some of those things. And some of the goals we're doing great on, we're reducing our land use chemicals, pesticides, and such. We've met that goal of 40%, and around the food, well, 36% this year is 50% last year. And our food purchasing guidelines were at about 11%, but there's a lot of things that we're working on getting towards that, and there's definitely progress being made. And there's a lot of things to build a culture of sustainability in general. I'm out of time, so I won't go through it. But everything I mentioned today you could find out by looking at sustainability.umich.edu. So all of the reports, links to all of the institutes and everything I mentioned, all the goals, all the projects are all there. So please take note and look at it, and I'll stick around for questions. Thank you.
Next, we're going to hear about the city's programs and the climate and the climate action plan progress, and that's going to come from Nate Geisler. And Nate works as the energy programs analyst for the city of Ann Arbor. That's part of the systems planning unit that focuses on long-range asset planning while advancing sustainability initiatives like the climate action plan. Nate is not just a technical whiz who understands the complexity of creating and maintaining highly efficient buildings and managing energy systems for the city's internal operations, but he also gets that the city of Ann Arbor has a vital role to play in advancing clean energy and climate solutions in a larger community. So please help me welcome Nate Geisler.
Thank you, Mike. Thank you, Anya. Thank you, Wayne. Thank you, Sean. Our future speakers here in a moment. And thank you all for being here tonight. It's hard to believe this is the fifth year for the forums that we've held, and this is not my first time up here, but it's always great to be down and have a conversation about these issues, in particular our climate action plan. As Mike mentioned, it was approved by City Council in 2012, and it was a little bit ahead of the President's climate action plan, which came maybe a year or so later, and that's driven a lot of the policy and commitments at the federal level that have since come forward. Credit's due to the state's Department of Natural Resources and the Environment, as it was then known, who offered a grant to develop this plan for Ann Arbor and a handful of other communities in Michigan. So the plan was adopted in December of 2012. We're now at the start of 2016, and the timing is right. We just had this large agreement that was convened again here in December in Paris. Mike spoke to our city council as part of the climate partnership update, and really that was this Monday at city council, describing how our plan in spirit and in content is consistent with the aims of the Paris Agreement, which again is to contain temperature increases to below 2 degrees Celsius. We don't have a degree goal in our plan, but we do have a GHG reduction target for both 2025 that, again, is consistent with the 25% reduction set by the University of Michigan, who was involved as we crafted our plan, and again, a 90% reduction, as it says here, by 2050. The plan does not and could not articulate from 2025 to 2090 how exactly we get there. There's a lot of big things that have to happen, not only within things that we can do within the city, but also more broadly throughout the state. And that's why at the bottom here I mentioned the Clean Power Plan, which is an outcome of President Obama's Climate Action Plan and will have a large impact on coal plants and other power plants and the need to reduce, I believe, 32% by 2030 emissions that are happening. And likewise at the state, for those who don't know, we are one of several states to have a renewable portfolio standard, a requirement for large utilities, publicly owned, or I'm sorry, investor-owned utilities to meet a share of their inventory from renewables, at least on electricity. And here in Michigan, consumers in Detroit Edison have a 10% requirement that was recently attained because the initial time frame for that legislation was 2015. And so here we are at the end of 2015, and where the RPS, the new renewable standard, goes is, it's not anyone's guess, but there's a lot of talk and a lot of uncertainty in Lansing, anything from thoughts to repeal it, to maintain it, to strengthen it. Some states have managed to lose some of their commitments, but most states and those involved are finding ways to go beyond certainly 10%, as we have here in Michigan. So following that state policy, and as we'll see in a second, how we supply our grid is certainly integral to how we can reduce emissions, no matter what we can do here in Ann Arbor. Mike also mentioned the Climate Partnership, an integral partner in these forums, other outreach events that we do throughout the city. Really an idea was over 98% of the emissions in Ann Arbor, again, community-wide, are beyond the control of the municipality. And so we really need a community-wide effort to raise awareness and build the kind of support that's necessary to make sure that our businesses, the commercial and industrial sector, and all of us in our homes, that we're doing our part and helping to meet these goals. So the Ecology Center here in River Watershed Council, we have other partners like the Clean Energy Coalition, commissioners like Wayne Appleyard, who will be up here after me, people very concerned about this issue and working hopefully on behalf of you all to move this along, since everybody can't attend meetings with the frequency with which we do it. So where are we? We're, since 2015 just wrapped up, we're looking to collect both our own data internally and that from DTE in particular, and other sources regarding transportation and these sorts of things. But the plan articulates that in between 2000 and 2010, there's a slight increase in overall emissions. There will possibly be an improvement, though we don't have all the data yet, from that 10% renewable standard, but it remains to be seen, and I don't think we'll see a large increase community-wide in the overall reduction. But we've laid out a series of updates in the slides that follow that talk about, within the four areas of the plan's organized by energy and buildings, land use and access, resource management and community and health. And we use these three categories: underway, in progress, or still getting started. And underway essentially is a little bit like implemented, but we don't want to say it's complete, because anything even that's implemented is not done. So we like to consider it underway. And we do have eight among the 80 actions that are underway, several more in progress, and 40% or so that are still getting started. So very quickly, though it's very important, I want to talk about adaptation. Our plan was really focused on mitigation, the reduction of emission sources and how we reduce our carbon equivalent footprint. But climate adaptation is all about the impacts that we're now seeing and how do we adjust to the new reality. And we really are fortunate to have the Climate Center in Gliese and Glacie and the resources that Anya mentioned that have demonstrated that between 1950 and 2010, precipitation is up 40%. We've seen, observed, not modeled, this is observed rain gauge, if you will, data that shows precipitation is increasing, and not just basic rain, the most extreme storms are happening at greater frequency. So we've had a wet weather technical advisory group. We're revising our stormwater standards. Code red is an emergency alert system for things like flooding that may become more common. We have a stormwater utility in Ann Arbor that allows for us to do a number of things to adapt to climate change, in particular as it impacts Ann Arbor around the issue of precipitation, as I mentioned. Again, we're doing as much as we can with green street policies that encourage infiltration through various engineering and simpler techniques as well. So we're also looking to build these sort of adaptive strategies into our capital improvement planning process, which is large projects that exceed $100,000 per year go into this plan that we have to figure out how to prioritize, and increasingly looking at how each project is adaptive to climate and how it meets our sustainability goals. I mentioned a Green Streets policy, a very adaptive strategy under resource management. We now have an urban community forest management plan that looks at how we diversify our tree canopy in Ann Arbor, how we increase it from the low 30% to maybe somewhere near 40% canopy cover throughout Ann Arbor, and being cognizant of the possibility of species regimes changing under a warming climate. Our solid waste plan update is underway, and there's a lot of work to increase recycling. We have zero waste events like the city's Green Fair and Earth Day, but really ensuring that every city-sponsored event is a zero waste event. And an organics management plan is commencing soon to look at expanded collection for things like composting, whether year-round composting is possible, those sorts of things. And I'll mention the biodigester feasibility study again soon because it's a great one. We have, as I mentioned, only so much we as the city can do, but this is something that we've looked at various times in recent years. Last year, we conducted an initial feasibility study, and this month we're launching a really deeper look at how we can take some of this organic waste, both from our wastewater treatment plant, but also possibly restaurants, cafeterias, all organics that are within our reach, but then possibly expanding it out to maybe a regional biodigester as well. So we'll be looking into that this year to, again, increase the share of renewably generated energy that we can. We have a PACE program and a rental housing loan fund to provide some incentives for the commercial sector and renters. I don't have all enough time in the world to go into what PACE is about, but it's really a way to help encourage and provide attractive interest rates and terms for energy efficiency in the commercial sector. And we're hopeful that that will soon apply to residents so that we can provide these sorts of incentives at the residential sector as well. We're just not enabled right now through state legislation to do that. More community renewable energy projects. Wayne's going to talk about some of the work at the Energy Commission. This is a 42-kilowatt solar system at one of our Housing Commission properties, Miller Manor, that just went in 2015. Land use and access, the Arbor Bike program is underway. Sean and the Clean Energy Coalition work closely with the city and the University of Michigan, an important partner, to encourage more bike riding. The enhanced transit service was discussed that climate partners have been involved with. We're looking to do more around electric vehicles and a number of other issues related to the actual land use side of things. Reimagine Washtenaw is an effort you should become familiar with if you're not yet, as well as the interest in revisiting some of the downtown zoning incentives that we have. We have a website called a2energy.org that's meant to provide information and resources to residents, businesses, landlords, renters, the whole community. We're doing a lot to calibrate how our stormwater system functions and how we plan for those big storms. So things that really affect the community and, how we're adapting as well as mitigating our efforts around climate change. But, of course, in, as Wayne will, I think, get into as well, sustainable funding is one of these key things. We've done a lot of things around climate, but as pertains especially to community-facing energy work, we've managed to have support recently from City Council to begin that, but there still programmatically isn't a solution yet to sustainably funding this sort of work. Real quickly, as I'm pretty much out of time, this is, again, the, just so you know, a quick breakdown of where our emissions come from. And it's always our endeavor, both myself, Wayne at the Energy Commission, our Environmental Commission, and, of course, the Climate Partners, to look to other sources for inspiration, other cities, peer cities like Indianapolis and all the great work they're doing around electric vehicles. Minneapolis is doing a lot with their utility. They have an investor-owned utility, and I've come up with a pretty innovative partnership to, again, address this sustainable funding issue of how you deal with energy efficiency and climate on a big scale. Boulder, tons of work happening around solar and many other things in Boulder. Really, if you have some time, Google their issues around their local investor-owned utility and their interest in municipalizing their utility, one approach some cities are taking. East Lansing Solar, a very large installation of solar. At the time it was announced, was the largest in the state on campus. So, again, another place to look for the university as well. So you can find me afterwards as well, but there's my contact information. Appreciate you all coming out, and I'll hand it over to Wayne.
So I asked Wayne Appleyard earlier today what I should say in introduction of him, and he said, it doesn't matter what you say about me, and maybe that's because you all know Wayne, and there is nothing I can add. But for those who don't, Wayne is a long-practicing architect in this town and area and an owner of the Sun Structures firm. Wayne was designing green buildings before anyone else, I think, knew what green buildings were. And he was installing solar systems when few other people were believing anything about renewable energy and that it could be used effectively in powering homes and heating places. He was not just ahead of his time, he was generations ahead of his time. And Wayne has also been one of our, sorry if it sounds that way, but Wayne has also been one of our community's, if not our community's single most tireless champion of clean energy. So please welcome the chair of the Ann Arbor Energy Commission, Wayne Appleyard.
Thank you, Michael. That was wonderful. So the Energy Commission, that's Robert and I out at the Green Fair several years ago. It's one of the things that we do is we get out in the community and try and educate people about energy and the need to get off of fossil fuels and onto renewables to save energy. The Energy Commission was started in 1981, principally to create an energy plan for Ann Arbor, and we did that. The bylaws state that the Energy Commission is to oversee city policies and regulations in areas of energy efficiency, municipal and community energy production, and community education on programs relating to energy. In 1994, we did an update of the energy plan, and more recently in 2011 and 2012, we headed up creating the Climate Action Plan. One of the things that we do is try and nudge the people up in Lansing, get them to do things kind of the way we think they should be done. Several years ago, when Act 285 was in the works, we pushed hard to get a renewable portfolio standard. More recently, when there was a proposed constitutional amendment, we worked hard to try and get 25 by 25, which did not pass. Currently, there's a lot going on at the state. It's very involved. There's probably 8 or 10 different bills in the works. They have tried to eliminate net metering. They have tried to eliminate the renewable portfolio standard, and they have tried to say that burning things like tires is green. So we have a lot of work to do in trying to push them in the right direction, but most recently we passed a resolution that's headed up to the state now that is basically saying that we should move forward with potentially a 30% renewable portfolio standard and maintain net metering and preferably add onto it virtual net metering, which would allow us to more easily do community solar. We're working on a commercial benchmarking ordinance. Now, basically, that would require the larger commercial buildings in town to annually report to the city the amount of energy that they use. And then that information would be available to the public. It would help people who are either going to buy a building or rent part of a building to understand what it means to actually be in that building as far as energy use is concerned. And it also, since it's been done in several other communities, they have found that it really helps identify to the owner exactly what they're doing, how energy-wise, and how it compares to their competitors, and how they can potentially reduce their energy consumption, which actually works best for their bottom line. We're looking at streamlining the solar permitting process. So, with staff, we're currently talking to the building department to see how their process currently works and whether or not we can use some standardized forms and such to reduce the cost and time involved in getting permits for installing solar. And hopefully we'll be able to make it a little easier to install solar in the community. Solar property tax. This comes up. It actually came up this morning or yesterday morning on MLive, where there was a report about the report to the council on the climate action plan. Someone voiced how they had supposedly were being charged for 100% of the what they return on their solar installation was costing them, and so that they weren't making any money on it. And it's come up at this forum a couple of years ago as well. So we sat down with the assessor, and we found out initially that it's important to realize two things. First of all, that it's not a straightforward thing if you look at the increase in taxes from one year to the next, exactly what caused that change. And so some of the change that these people saw could very well not have been from adding solar, but from some other thing. Secondly, tax assessor is required by state law to assess a tax on anything that's an improvement on property unless it's exempted, and solar isn't. So, but with discussions with the assessor, they've changed a little bit the way they calculate the improvement, and so the tax has now been reduced to about 20% of the annual return, which is still more than we'd like it to be. So we're actually looking at the possibility of trying to convince council to enact a rule that says that in order to get a larger percentage of the municipal government's renewable energy, according to their goals, the water utility, which uses more electricity than any other part of the city government, could purchase from the individual the solar renewable energy credits at approximately the market value, which actually is very close to the current taxation rate, and thereby relieve the burden on the taxpayer and presumably improve and promote the use of solar energy in the community. We're working on trying to do community solar in the community. This is the first one in Michigan, up near Traverse City. A lot of municipal utilities are getting into this. Currently, DTE does not have a program to do this, and so we're trying to figure out a way to do that in Ann Arbor. Another thing is group buys. All across the country, there's a lot of solarize projects that have gone on in communities. There's a lot going on in Connecticut around that, where they get together and they buy a whole bunch of PV arrays from one supplier at 10 to 15% reduced cost. So they kind of simplify the process, take some of the fear out of doing the whole thing, and actually do a lot of solar that way. The program in Boulder was pretty unique in that they actually got into purchasing Nissan electric vehicles at a reduced price, which was quite amazing. They actually got it down because the state of Colorado has a $5,000 reduction tax credit. They got a brand new Nissan Leaf down to $11,000, which is pretty amazing. We can't do that here. It'd be like 16, but it'd still be a really good deal. We're looking at updating the Green Fleets program because it was initiated in 2004 and really focused on ethanol and biofuels and fuel efficiency. And with electric vehicles, we have a chance to really get away from combustion, which is what we really need to do in order to stop producing greenhouse gases. And we've also learned that the biofuels are actually not that good a thing. It's trading off from food production, and sometimes they produce as much greenhouse gas emissions as regular fuels do. So the big thing that we really want to do is get a sustainable funding source, as has been mentioned a little bit more earlier here. Because the scale of what we need to do to really achieve our goals is far beyond what's going on now. And what we've been doing is getting little impulses of small amounts of money to do a little program here and there, and then the money kind of goes away and comes back. And you don't get a good quality program that can really achieve our goals by doing that. So we're looking at one option is a carbon tax. And Boulder, back in 2007, passed a carbon tax at $7 per ton of carbon. They, in 2012, they upped it to $13 to $14 per ton. So it's basically taken off your electric bill, and it works out to about $21 per homeowner or $94 for a commercial meter. It raises $1.8 million. So they have a very ambitious program, and they have completed 13,000 home audits with rebates, 3,000 business audits with rebates. They've providing financing at 2.75% financing, and they've had 25% rebates on the home energy programs. And they also have, I should mention, they have, I want to make sure I get this right, I believe it is 20 megawatts worth of installed solar in their community. And Boulder is pretty similar to Ann Arbor in scale as far as number of occupants. We have a little over half a megawatt at this point. They have a little bit more sun. They're a little high above sea level, so they do a little better. But for the most part, we're way behind. So we're really hoping that we can come up with a way to get funding secured over the long haul. Just want to say we're just 11 citizens and a council member. We can't do it all ourselves. We have some wonderful staff, but it's limited. So you can be on subcommittees and help out and learn and do. Contact your council representatives and tell them that you really want this stuff to happen. And also go to a2energy.org to see ways that you can reduce your own energy usage.
Thanks, Wayne. And I would have mentioned this had I realized it earlier, but one of our elected officials, I believe that council person who serves on the Energy Commission, is in attendance here tonight. That's Chip Smith in the back of the room. And I'm delighted that one of our elected officials is here. Are there any other electeds that I've missed? I can't see past the fourth or fifth row without my glasses. But terrific to have one of our elected officials here with us. Our last but not least, definitely not least speaker here is Sean Reed, the founder and executive director of the Clean Energy Coalition, which, as you may know, is a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization dedicated to promoting clean energy technologies as a way to create healthier, energy-independent communities. It's great to have an organization like CEC here in Ann Arbor. Before working for the Clean Energy Coalition, Sean worked in the city of Ann Arbor's energy office and in the Detroit-based organization that's now known as EcoWorks. He's also worked in Africa and Asia and is going to share a big-picture global view of these issues with us from a personal perspective. Sean?
All right, so I'll be honest. I'm usually not much good for anything after 8 o'clock, except for brushing my teeth and going to bed. But I'm going to do my best. So this presentation, you know, you guys have heard a lot about different local policies, initiatives, things like that. This presentation is mostly about some personal experiences I've had and maybe a different take of looking at the same issues, but just from a different context. I'm not originally from Michigan. When I grew up, I grew up in Pennsylvania. The area is now very dense in hydraulic fracturing. It's been interesting to see that change. But near my house, this was the bridge that we had to cross nearly every day. If you look at it, you can tell it's not really a great bridge. There's probably some serious problems going on there. And after a while, I got a little bit concerned, went to the road commission and talked to them about the bridge. What are the plans for this bridge? And what they told me was a little bit shocking, although I find those types of things less shocking as time goes on. But they said that this bridge had a 97% chance of bridge failure in the next 3 years when they did the engineering study on it. And I don't know about you, but when I hear 97% chance of failure or whatever, it seems pretty severe. Also, if it happens to be something I drive my car over, it becomes concerning. Makes me think about this bridge collapse, which happened in Minneapolis a number of years ago. There were probably some telltale signs for that collapse, but still happened, and obviously a lot of people were hurt. Now, let me give you a different scenario. It doesn't have to do with growing up in Pennsylvania, but just imagine that you're going to see your doctor, and your doctor, this doctor, let's say is my doctor, he's very stern. So he ran a whole battery of tests on me, you know, did all the measurements and all those things, and he said to me, Sean, if you don't change your ways, quit smoking, quit drinking, lose some weight, exercise, you're going to have a 97% chance of a heart attack in the next few years. Now, if you heard that from your doctor, would you be concerned? Would you view it as maybe a wake-up call? Like maybe I need to do something somewhat different? Like going over that bridge, maybe I don't go over that bridge anymore. Or maybe I should listen to my doctor and start taking care of myself. And the thing about that 97% number is it's the same percentage of climate scientists near universal global consensus in the scientific community that humans are causing climate change. And the thing that I find really fascinating about these scientific reports when I read them is how these scientists with PhDs and lifetime laboratory experience and Nobel Prizes and supercomputers, the thing that you see in every single one of these reports is how they consistently underestimate how quickly and how severe climate change is happening because they cannot model the complete global system. All these things happen and it's like, didn't think of that. So there we are, near 97% certainty. Certainly, if you were to just listen to the media or read stuff, you would think, well, it's certainly not that high, but yet it is. So this brings to mind a quote from Rene Dubose, who said that trend is not destiny. What this makes me think about is I'm sure many of the people in this room saw An Inconvenient Truth, and you remember that chart where Al Gore gets up on his scaffolding, whatever that is, and rises 20 feet in the air to demonstrate how now global CO2 levels are essentially off the chart, right? Nothing within the historical time frame makes any sense. But the thing is, here we are, a generation that is at, you know, essentially maybe the wrong place at the right time to actually do something to try to change that trend, to make it so that it doesn't have to be destiny in any sort of way. So what I want to do is I just want to go over, point out three kind of core principles, and then talk a little bit about some people that I lived and worked with and the approach that they take and how that exemplifies this. So the three resiliency principles, which I think moving forward to be successful in a world of climate change, we need to be resilient. The three things are diversity, or being diverse, simple, and efficient. Those seem like very simple things to me, but I think that is the very wonderful thing about trying to address climate change, is I don't think we need the energy miracle that Bill Gates is talking about. I think that the technology that exists in the world is what we need to solve these problems, and the bigger issues are more having political will and the resources to do so. So what am I going to talk about? So I was born in Africa in a country called Malawi, and I went back to live and work in Africa in Tanzania before I moved to Michigan. I was working for a Tanzanian NGO when I was there. It's a Maasai tribe, and for those of you who aren't familiar with the Maasai, they're people of cattle. They live in a semi-arid zone and really walk the commons with their cattle to take them to sources of water and food. And, you know, looking at it, you could say, well, that's a pretty sustainable lifestyle, right? So what I want to talk about is how Maasai people use energy as part of their daily life. This is a young Maasai girl cooking dinner for her family, and she's doing it in the most traditional way. She's got three stones, and she's feeding wood into it, heating up some beans probably in that pan. The thing about that girl and that wood is that the Maasai view trees as being extremely sacred. You can't just go out and cut down a tree, because a tree is a prime source of shade in the intense heat. It provides food for the animals to forage on. So the girls have to go out and walk 10 or 15 miles a day in order to go get the energy source for their families to heat the food, prepare dinner. But the Maasai people are also extremely resourceful. So how are they being resilient in the face of a very difficult situation? Here we have a group of Maasai women that are learning an alternate way of cooking using a rocket stove. What's so great about a rocket stove is that it burns fuel extremely efficiently. The Maasai girls still have to go get the wood, but they don't have to get as much or as often because of the efficiency of this thing. Also, it's made in Tanzania and also easy to fix if something were to break. Another means of cooking, using biogas. They use the resources that they have. Because they have cattle, they collect the dung from the cattle, put it in essentially a large bladder, and let it, let it digest, is the way you could look at it, create the gas, which they then use to cook their meals. They use it for lighting. Some people actually use it in their irons to iron their clothes. But a renewable resource, very simple, very easy to get. Or using a solar oven. The sun is an intense resource out there, right? So instead of having to go get firewood, you just sit there with this thing. It heats up to several hundred degrees in the intense sun that's out there. There's nothing to feed, and it's just there. Very little to break, too. It's a final one I'll show you. This is a Maasai homestead. On the right, you have a very traditional Maasai house. On the left, a modern one made out of concrete. And I really like this modern Maasai house because it has a PV panel on the roof. Now, in most homes like this, that's really just there to power one or two light bulbs that are in the house. But technology's changing. If somebody had the resources, they could also be using that for cooking. Would that be the best thing? You know, it's hard to say, but it's another option and one that uses the resources that are available to them. What's fascinating for me in living and working with the Maasai people is how they have essentially leapfrogged a lot of the stages of development that we went through very slowly. So instead of putting up telephone lines and running landlines, they're just not doing that at all. They're moving right on to cell phones. They're not putting up the power lines for the electricity. They're moving right on to distributed generation. So the question is, you know, if a people with as limited resources as the Maasai are able to pull off this type of stuff, power their schools with renewable energy, use renewable feedstocks on a daily basis, you know, it seems to me that here in Ann Arbor, with the resources we have, that we could most likely be doing more. And I think we should, especially since when you look at that 97% number, it's important. So I know I'm going over time, but just so I don't leave you with the impression that I think we should all just use biogas from our cows or, you know, stand outside with a solar cooker, just present a little snapshot of history here where we look and we have the 19th century very inefficient use of wood, which was local for heating, right? Inefficient, pretty dirty probably, but a renewable local resource. 20th century, things start getting extremely complicated. You have pipelines transferring resources, furnaces that we can no longer fix, combinations of fuel sources, whether it's electricity or gas. So I'm hoping that as we move into the 21st century, that we have a bit more of a move towards simplification, using more systems that can be more passive in nature. I've personally tried to do this in my personal life, and I'll say that I found it exciting and rewarding, although it's usually a bit more work, that's for sure. Coming back to 97%, thing is, I mentioned to you guys, trend is not destiny. We are the ones that can shape the future. We're in the right position to do so. Differences for our kids, trend is destiny because they're going to get the future that we hand off to them. They're going to get the earth that we give them. And it's my feeling that we have a real responsibility to give them an earth that's in the best position that it could be in, which is certainly not where we are now, but where I think we're fully capable of going. So, thank you.
I want to encourage a free sharing of ideas, whether it's in the form of questions or comments or whatever you have. I just have two ground rules that I want to I'm going to insist on. And ground rule number one is that that anyone who comes to the microphone be as respectful as you can of the other people in this room and our presenters and all. And ground rule number two is please no filibustering. Make your comment. If you go on a long time, don't go on for a long time, okay? So please, let's...
So if you have a comment, just come right up to the mic here.
Hi, thank you very much for the wonderful discussion. Just a question for the U of M person. Is the movement for divestment getting much traction?
I would say with the students, it's getting a lot of traction. There's a very strong effort, and they have been doing a lot to try to get that up to leadership. But there was a sort of a response from leadership that that's not something that they are going to pursue at this point.
And how about investment in, say, sustainable energy? Is that picking up for the university with all their funds?
Yes, I think. Investment in renewable energy is something that people are interested in. So the divestment that's become a little bit more of a sticky situation.
Okay, thank you.
But are you talking about the stock portfolio?
Yes.
Is that what you mean?
Yes.
Oh, I'm not sure about that. I could certainly find out for you.
Because you think they would want to, you know, walk the talk, so to speak. You know?
Yeah, and I don't know about the stock portfolio offhand, sorry.
Hi, thanks for all your efforts. I appreciate the presentation tonight. I'm Vince Grusso at the Allen's Creek Watershed Group, and the discussion about flooding I think is important. I think we're facing some major flooding issues in Ann Arbor. We have construction as we speak in the floodplain, which, you know, shouldn't be happening. I think we have an opportunity with the Greenway Master Plan that's coming up that I volunteer to be on. The CAC, the Citizens Advisory Commission, to deal with a lot of issues in one way with a greenway, alternative transportation, reduced flood hazard, have a park space downtown or in the near downtown. So I hope that the folks in the environmental effort, you know, take the greenway as a great opportunity for the city that will be here for generations. One personal note, we had a bid to put solar panels on our house late last summer. And then I found out that the state is considering doing away with net metering, which was very disappointing. And I guess it's still a possibility, but if you could make a comment on the state and how, as Ann Arbor, could influence the state, I think net metering is a great opportunity to reduce carbon emissions, and I think we really need net metering like a lot of parts of the United States, and we're right on the verge of losing it. So thanks again for your efforts.
If I might comment, nothing certain up in Lansing, but as of late last year, it looked like a strange coalition of the solar folks and the kind of right-wing folks were going to keep any change from net metering happening. So I think net metering is safe in the short term. This has been something that's been pushed by ALEC in several states, and so we need to remain vigilant and try and maintain that. But I think at least for the next year or so, it's not going to change in the current bills. There was something in the Senate bill, but not in the House bill. The House bill was actually got out of committee. But like I say, you never know exactly what you're going to get out of Lansing. I'm not sure how well they listen to Ann Arbor down here, but we try.
I just want to make one more point on the greenway. I read that getting out of your car and on a bicycle is like living in a net zero house. So if we can have more opportunities for people to bike, especially off the roads, I think we would get a lot more bicyclists and a lot less people driving and reduce our carbon footprint tremendously that way. Thanks.
Thank you.
First question is for Anya, and it has to do with this seeming competition that we have with Michigan State University, if you will. And they recently announced a 10-megawatt program of putting photovoltaics in parking lots. Which is pretty darn impressive, and I'm wondering if there's a way to leverage this competitive feeling we have to maybe get an action from higher up. I mean, it takes kind of big actions to get big results. Any way of using that?
I think it's a great idea. Yeah. we have been paying attention to what other schools are doing and are aware of that and impressed by it. And I know that there's been, there is a commitment to doing a lot more renewable stuff on campus. How that will come out and where it's appropriate is still sort of to be determined. But I think it's using the competition to push people along, it's a great idea.
And along the same lines, I've always been proud to be part of Ann Arbor and the efforts to do renewable energy and energy efficiency. And there was a time when we were unquestionably the leaders in the state for renewable energy and energy efficiency, but now we're seeing Lansing, a city of Lansing, announcing a 40-megawatt solar energy done by their local government. We're seeing Grand Rapids make great strides, cities all over. Again, this question of pride of somehow pulling together as the community that used to lead, that wants to lead, that has the best resources and the best minds to again try to achieve that leadership position, which we're all willing to help. I think we are the best leaders and best.
Any of you want to respond to that?
Well, I might say that one of the reasons Lansing is getting that big solar array is that they have a municipal utility and we don't. It's a lot easier when you have a utility that's not there to make a profit for individuals but to service the community. And so we have a little bit of a stumbling block because of our current privately owned utility.
Thank you, Dave. Yes?
Hi, I've got two questions. One, I've noticed out at the Ann Arbor-Saline Road Meyer's store, there's a Tesla charging facility for cars. Does anyone know how that came about?
Dave, do you want to answer that?
Identify yourself, please, Mr. Conkle.
Okay, I'm Dave Conkle, and I'm a member of the Michigan Electric Automobile Association and an active member in putting electric car charging around the state of Michigan. I do know that one of the higher-up managers of the Ann Arbor Myers actually owns a Tesla. And as Tesla is expanding their reach across the United States and trying to build a network of available charging stations that they actually pay for themselves, that he was able to work with his contacts inside Myers and with the Tesla people and bring that charging station here to the Ann Arbor Myers. So it's actually a great victory, and I believe there's 6 or 8 Tesla chargers there. We're lucky.
I think that you'll see a lot more fast charging stations out in the marketplace, and it'll those stations, a lot of them will be under the same type of model where essentially you have a automaker that's putting them in. So besides Tesla, Nissan is taking a very strong interest in doing that, and we'll be putting in a lot of charging stations in Southeast Michigan. And primarily what they're looking to do is to address the range anxiety issues that people have when they purchase an electric vehicle. So having that public fast charging station available can actually be very good for their bottom line, and more than pays for itself in increased vehicle sales.
It's a little unfortunate that they haven't actually standardized plugs, because if you own a Leaf, you can't use one of those Tesla chargers.
Well, I would say certainly, and we recently had a grant through Washtenaw County that allowed us to partner closely with the county, but also Ypsilanti, around greening of our rental housing in Ann Arbor and throughout the county. Both Ypsilanti and Ann Arbor, not surprisingly, have a large share. In fact, the majority, it's just a little over 50% here, but figuring out how to address the split incentive problems of landlords paying for utilities or not, and what that means for their ability to make improvements or their tenants' behavior change. A number of things spun off from that, including that rental loan fund that I mentioned earlier as part of a U of M student project. So we certainly do work with folks, but I think there's always more to do. And at the same time, we got our grant to do the Climate Action Plan. Ypsilanti also received a grant, as did Dearborn, which is another city that we work closely with. So I love it.
We do projects across the state. I mean, we do quite a bit in Ann Arbor, but there's a lot that can be done across Michigan and also outside of Michigan.
Certainly some projects, scale is helpful. And so, for instance, if we go ahead with a group buy program, we could very well do it countywide, so that we'd get the advantage of scale.
I'll weigh in on this too. The Boulder program Wayne's referring to is now a 3-county program, and a lot of the initiatives within the climate plan are ones that may have to be implemented on a more regional basis. A few other examples, the transit initiatives are largely regional and already have been, service has been expanded to Ann Arbor, Ypsilanti, Ypsi Township, and now coming Scioto Township. Some of the adaptation work dealing with flood management, stormwater management also has some countywide and regional aspects, and a lot of the other initiatives within the plan go beyond city boundaries, even if the city's playing a major leadership role on them. But real good question. Sir? Oh, sorry. Any other? Here we go.
Is there any kind of credit starter for people that want to start putting a roof with solar house, you know, solar panels? Can you get credit, or is there any help for people in Ann Arbor that want to do that?
Well, there still is, if you're not aware, a federal tax credit that would reduce the installation cost 30%. We're looking, I mentioned the PACE program. We'd like to see that for residential applications. Occasionally, it's been a little fluid, but DTE has had solar incentive programs, but those have since been fully subscribed, as they would say. But that federal credit, which has been extended, is certainly the biggest thing out there to be aware of.
You have provided us with a kaleidoscope of activities, and you are some of the most knowledgeable people in our community. If you had to pick a project for the community to focus on that would bring us a result, a measurable result, quickly, efficiently, and enable us to see success, what would each of you pick? I would love to be inspired to do the next thing, because you provided us with such a long list of things to be done that it's quite daunting.
Who's going to start?
I'll start. Just going off my last comments, I mean, something it's small steps we sometimes take, but we put together an information piece that's still available at the customer service counter at City Hall, really driving home the point that this cost of solar has really dramatically come down in the last handful of years from even just 5-6 years ago. And so now, that's not to say everybody, solar is for everyone, but really recognizing that we're not as constrained from a resource availability. Germany certainly leads with sun, with solar installations, installed capacity. But trying to think about how we can go, where we can go next with solar is something I think is very exciting.
All right, big advance on solar. That's the first one.
Solar.
I'm personally heavily influenced by what I'm reading at the time. Recently, I read a book called Bikenomics, and makes a very compelling case as to why investments in bike infrastructure are really wise choices in terms of both adding extreme value to the community. Community becomes a much more livable and valued place, but also the multipliers economically are huge, and certainly much more for the money that you get than by improving roads. Personally, I know in tracking this issue that bike and pedestrian safety and being able to do more of that is a top issue both for the community and the Ann Arbor City Council, and it would be nice to see some active steps taken on that, because you go to other communities, like you go to San Francisco or elsewhere, and it's like you see what it can be like to actually bike around and not feel concerned about getting hit by a car, and it totally changes the world for people. So I think it would be nice to see more happen on that front, especially given the impact that automobiles have on our environment.
I can follow up on that, since mine is a bit related. My background's urban planning, and I do believe urban planning can save the world. So so my pitch, it's not something that is quickly seen, but I think people can quickly take positions to support smart growth and compact development near where there can be more transit lines and keep the green areas green and give more people opportunities to bike and walk to their destinations rather than having to drive 50 miles one way to work. So that's my position, I think.
It's hard to choose one. I think I'd have to agree with Nate to go with a solar program, but to cheat a little bit, I'd like to actually do a package program that includes energy efficiency, because we all know that the energy efficiency is so important to solving the whole problem, and it's sort of got the least glitz to it, and so everybody wants to do the solar, but nobody's really concerned about putting more insulation in their attic. So there's potentially a chance to bundle that, since you make it just a little bit bigger purchase, and basically the insulation or whatever else you do to the home at the same time reduces their energy load, so the solar is actually able to do a larger percentage.
So how's
and
that?
I should say, just cheap.
Oh, go ahead.
Weatherizing and insulation are the big two that we promote at A2Energy.org. So while I stated solar, it is, I would reiterate Rain's remarks. So
I guess we've got three ideas there, three big ideas.
Sir. Hi. Thank you, everyone. You guys were great tonight. I heard a lot about solar tonight, and it's music to our ears. We are a local installation company, and we've done a lot of installations in Ann Arbor and surrounding areas. So that's music to our ears. You spoke briefly, Nate, I think, about the soft costs and improving efficiencies, everything with the permitting process or anything like that. I was hoping perhaps you could elaborate briefly on that, but also wanted to know what can we do as a local solar installation company to help play a role here.
And before you answer, let me just let folks know we've been given special dispensation by the library to go a little bit longer. So we've got about 10 more minutes. So if other people want to join the discussion, just line up. So,
well, I'll chime in and Wayne can follow up. We have a subcommittee of the Energy Commission right now that's really focused this year on ways to advance community solar as it's defined, but also more loosely defined, and so I think addressing these soft costs are really important as we get more and better acquainted with the processes at our local building department and look to streamline things. Hopefully that does make a difference. I've saw a number of emails today with Emily Drennan, who's in the back and deserves a lot of credit for the event here today around how we can do that. I've been in touch with the International Council of City Managers and City and Managers and Administrators, ICMA, I could be butchering the exact acronym, but ICMA and the SunShot Initiative, which is a Department of Energy, to do a workshop here in Michigan, either in Ann Arbor or nearby. And certainly the Energy Commission is open to the public. There's public input, so we welcome hearing from local installers who have a service to provide or in addition, involvement in the subcommittees like Wayne mentioned.
And just to add to that, one of the subcommittees is in the process of putting together a survey that they're going to send out through GLREA to installers to get their feedback. And so if you're not a member of GLREA, you can give me your card, and I'll make sure that you get a copy of the survey so you can be included. And it's basically asking installers how hard they think it is to get through the process in Ann Arbor and what they personally think could be improved.
Sir.
This goes back to Wayne's comment about Lansing having a municipality or a municipal utility. And so I was just wondering, I think it was Boulder that they told their utility that if you don't give us the renewable energy that we want, we're going to build our own municipal utility. So how could we as Ann Arbor and, a city and a university use the clout that we have, to tell DTE we want this or think about other possibilities, considering that energy choice in Michigan is limited?
Who wants to respond to that?
I should probably answer that, since I'm not officially connected with the city and can speak as a citizen and not as a staff member from the city. We have talked off and on about trying to create a municipal utility of our own. It's a very difficult thing to do. Nobody's done it in the state of Michigan in a very, very long time. But we are watching Boulder, which is trying to do that. They are not through the process by any stretch. It's already cost them several million dollars, I believe. And whether or not we could actually come up with the money and the will to try and go through that process that involves rooms full of lawyers, basically, and a lot of time, I don't know. But on the other end of things, certainly trying to join forces with the university, who is maybe their second or third largest purchaser of electricity, DTEs, and together with the city, we get even bigger as far as the percentage of their electrical sales could possibly help. It's always hard to know what you can get out of DTE. Several years ago, we talked about franchises, we were able to get a few things from them by trying to work that angle. So it may be time to actually try and pressure them. Certainly, if there was a citizens' uprising basically saying that, you know, we want a municipal utility and started pressuring the city council to do that, that could certainly either make it happen or strike enough fear in DTE to get a little something. I don't know.
I guess one other thing that I would add there is that, you know, in some of the earlier presentations, people were talking about a carbon tax, and essentially anybody that's a DTE customer already pays a carbon tax in the form of the energy optimization line item that is on your utility bill. And I think one thing to think about is whether, you know, you're paying that surcharge every month, whether you feel like your community is getting its values worth out of what you're putting into it, because my guess is that probably amounts to a couple million dollars a year that's going into it from Ann Arbor, and maybe you feel like you'd like to see something a little different happen with it.
And that money, of course, is spent throughout is pooled with the other money in the DT service area and provides programs of different sorts throughout all of Southeast Michigan and further.
I hope I can project. I recently had a stroke, so I'll do the best I can. I used to be able to talk loudly. Recently, the university has sponsored a lecture by Naomi Klein, and who wrote a book a few years back. I recently read it. It's called That Changes Everything. And she kind of course, agrees with everyone. She basically said the climate issue is urgent. But she identified the main culprit, you know, worldwide, is the fossil fuel industrial complex. And I would like to ask one of you or all of you, do you agree with her?
Sure. It's a force to be reckoned with. They have huge amounts of money invested in this and huge amounts of money to be gained by continuing to combust. And part of what we need to do is get beyond the myth that we need fossil fuels. And you should go look at solutionsprojects.com, which has basically one scenario for every state in the union to actually be 100%, use 100% renewables and stop combusting, which is basically what we need to do. She's right. It's the force. You know, it's not, we don't have a big technical challenge. We have a political will challenge, and that's principally a problem of all of those monies that go from fossil fuel companies and big utilities that burn fossil fuels to our politics. The one that comes to mind is that there was a recent study that looked at the two energy committees on the state level that were working on all these bills that we talked about. And every one of those members, except for one, had received contributions from either DTE or both. The majority of them got contributions from both. So, and the way to get around that is to call up your congressman and say you don't like what they're doing. You know,
the one thing I would add beyond what Wayne said is I read that book this past summer, and you know, like a lot of books on climate change, it can leave you feeling kind of sad. But I really liked some of the summarizing points that she made at the end, where essentially she was saying that, you know, as a means of really addressing this issue, it's really important to not go after it from the standpoint of like, well, we're just a bunch of environmentalists and we're just going to do this. But it's really to see it from the broader perspective, that what's happening as it relates to climate change is part of a larger political and social pattern of, you know, disempowerment of huge groups of people, and that if we were able to collaborate and push for things like redistricting reform or, you know, changing the way the tax system is and trying to get more equitable distribution of resources that already exist, because there's a common good to be gained from that, that we would probably be more successful as a movement.
Okay, I do want to be cognizant of the time, but I want to let people know we have two more quick questions.
Thank you.
Thank you. I was stimulated to get up. My name is Alan Haber. On the call for a citizen uprising, because I think that in some way that is really what we need. There are industries, there are big powers, as we've just spoken, that is keeping us on this suicide march over into the abyss. And the oil industry, that the university does not want to consider divestment, that the high level, the students do, that's an issue that people in the town should know about. The one thing I want to put forward as a suggestion, I've been working on that the center of town right next door should be a community commons and a park. And part of that is there should be an educational place right in the center of town where these questions, where the demonstrations of alternative technology, where the other ways of green way of living on top of the parking structure, which is the old way of living with all the cars down there, let them be buried a little bit. But on the top, we should have an educational place where these ideas come to the people, because people are very not aware. And if they're visually demonstrated in the center of town, I think that would be a great benefit. So I hope people will see that besides just the value of a park, the value of a green place for teaching is very important to bring these ideas forward.
Well, I like Speaker's Corner in London. It's really just nothing more than a soapbox at its simplest level. It's great for discussion.
Okay, I just came back from Paris. I was participating in the COP21 meeting, and there were a lot of talk about reforestation. But I was a little sad that there were very little talk about stopping to cut the Amazon, because we learned there that the Amazon is not only the land, but this huge pump. And a lot of people, especially native people, feel that it is changing the climate very rapidly because we don't stop cutting it. So that's the second thing after the fossil fuel, is stopping to cut the forest. Thank you. Don't you think so?
I think we'll close it up on that comment. Thank you very much. And thanks to everyone tonight. Let us give one big round of applause to our four terrific panelists. To Emily Drennan and the city staff who helped organize this event. And to all of you for coming out tonight. On your way out, if you would like to be, well, got one thing to offer. We've got a sign up in the back that you might have filled out as you were coming in. If you didn't, you have the opportunity there to suggest the one thing you would like to see the city work on to affect some real climate solutions. And if you would like to be in touch with the Ann Arbor Climate Partnership, leave us your contact information there, and you'll get information and reports and news from us about about what's happening on climate solutions in Ann Arbor. But again, thank you very much for coming out tonight, and let's move forward and make something big happen in 2016. Thank you.